I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. So where did we get this nasty NAGO hangover of a presidential campaign? Try this for size. It's the 90s, back to haunt us. The first Clinton decade. The mostly peace and all-time prosperity decade when a lot of bad seedlings took root, like mass incarceration and the cool idea of regime change for Iraq. The parallel is the OJ trial from 95, back this season in two Think Again TV series, documentary and drama. The 90s were Hillary, high and then humbled in the White House, the Donald migrating from Ivana and the Plaza to Hollywood cameos and ultra-celebrity. The 90s gave us the Rodney King model for bad policing, Columbine for mass murder, Charles Barkley for trash talk. It was a boom decade with an undertow. David Foster Wallace wrote the great book of it, Infinite Jest, but his lost and lonely generation asking, why are we so sad? Channel surfing in the 90s, you'd have heard some of this.
I just want to say, you know, can we all get along? Can we get along?
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Well, what's the show about? It's about nothing. No story? No, forget the story.
President Clinton?
Yeah, hi. I'm here to see Lisa Simpson.
You read my letter?
Much of it, yes.
We are taking the first steps in a contract with the American people.
Hillary Clinton? I can't stand that woman.
I know. Maybe we could all take a page from her book.
This will not be another Vietnam.
There will be a giant sucking sound going south.
I say slack off, because you're only going to be alive for 70 years if you're lucky, right? You know, have fun.
Smoke pot.
It was the first decade after the Cold War. The end of history, they said. Ha! There was breakdown in Rwanda, breakup in Yugoslavia. Remember that balmy climate summit in Rio, 92? So much business unfinished. Maureen Dowd gets us started. The Tart, New York Times columnist who won a Pulitzer Prize for her coverage of the Clinton White House. She's famous again this season for her fighting phone tapes with Donald Trump, proving that some reporters can get access without buying in. She can beat him up as a misogynist bully, and next week he's on the phone again.
Not anymore. He just flamed me on Twitter this weekend as wacky and neurotic and crazy, which are the adjectives he always uses about women.
Terms of affection, right?
Yeah, exactly. I wish he'd given me a more thought-out nickname, like Chuck Todd is Sleepy Eyes and Elizabeth Warren is Pocahontas, so I hate to just be one of the crowd with wacky and crazy.
Listen, you're a witness and player in this whole circus since the 90s, and I want you to review it. Everybody's saying, where in the world did this campaign come from? We say, no, it's obvious now. It's from the 90s. Go back to those early days of your own career on the Times.
Right. Well, that's why I wanted to do the book, because I realized I had this weird narrative arc for these two people starting in the 90s when they both came on the national stage. I went out with him on an early foray to a speech to test the waters in Miami with Cuban Americans.
God, 99. I thought you were going to say I went out with him.
Oh, no. And he just looked at the rope line and scampered away shyly because he wasn't really ready to run and he didn't really think he would do well. And now he figured he was 69 and it was now or never. And I think the most surprised person that Trump is where Trump is Trump. You know, so at any rate, then in those days, he was very supportive of Bill and Hillary. And when Bill couldn't get into a golf club after the Mark Rich pardon, he was kind of in bad odor. Trump let him into his golf club in Westchester and used to play golf with him and talk about girls. And than he would donate to Hillary's campaign and the foundation and always say nice things about Hillary. So that was where they were in the 90s. And then you flash forward and it's going to be the nastiest, most ruthless campaign in modern history. But the funny thing is there are a couple things that were totemic of the 90s that are totemic of this campaign, which is greed is good, which is something you could hang on both candidates. And Monica, probably Trump will bring that up in the debates. He already has talked about the blue stained dress. And in a way, it's like a Seinfeld election because it's really about nothing, you know, except these two
brilliant,
two most famous people on the planet that nobody really seems to know.
It was also the introduction of Pharmacy Nation, the embedding of a drug culture illegally too. Trump the non-druggy, as it turns out.
I know. It's so amazing that he's so kind of volatile sober. You know, he just does the volatility straight up. I was surprised at how gushing my columns were about Hillary and healthcare, and she went up to Capitol Hill to present it. And she was campaigning as Bill's wife in 92. I was very supportive because I thought the first lady job is such a tightrope. It's so antiquated for someone like Hillary and now Michelle with the exact same educational credentials as their husbands. But I was very supportive. I called her performance dazzling. But that's when this very self-destructive and destructive to the Democratic Party pattern kicked in, that she would cut out the press completely. She would hide behind this wall of secrecy and defensiveness. It was my way or the highway. And she didn't ask Bill for help because at that point, the stories about Paula Jones and the Arkansas troopers were coming out and she was mad at him. So he couldn't help her sell her plan. So the healthcare thing kind of went under. And that's the same pattern that she has always had, where something that should work or a problem that's relatively minor snowballs and turns into this long frenzy with her foes and the press just because she doesn't level in the first place.
But then there's been a recasting since then. You refer to her sequence of personalities as the new stainless steel kitchen in the house that won't sell. But what's the new pitch to be a kind of teacher, primary school teacher, mother?
That's such an interesting question, Chris, because that's a really good example of the 90s. The aides to the Clinton campaign during that 92 race wrote her a memo, and they said, now we are going to reintroduce you. We're going to show the real Hillary. We're going to show you as a mother who cares about children in this country. And they did the very same thing this week. Different people writing her the same memos now that they did in 92. It's just strange that whatever it is that she can't convey what they see and she sees as her true self to the public. Like, you know, a Clinton friend said to me recently, oh, if you could sit down with her, you'd like her so much. She's a hoot in private. But they say it so often, and then we never see it, that it's become a joke around our office. She's a hoot in private.
How do you describe the real one?
I mean, whenever she apologizes, it just always feels like she's sorry that it became a fuss, not that she's sorry that she did something wrong, like the server, which was really reckless, or the vote for the Iraq War, which was really bad. I mean, I think that was just done for political viability because Bill's advisors told her she had to seem strong as a woman if she wanted to run for president. But she always does her homework. And in that case, she didn't do her homework. She didn't read the National Intelligence Estimate. And that just tells me that it was a preordained decision based on her political future. So, you know, she'll be idealistic sometimes. And then that, to me, was very cynical. Because she's one of only a handful of people who might have stopped that war.
You gave us your version of the real Hillary. What's the real Donald, Maureen?
Well, it's interesting. So is he, you know, what he used to be, which is this kind of blinking white rapper, a short-fingered, vulgarian, bon vivant, liberal, supported gun control and abortion rights, and donated to Hillary Clinton's Senate campaign, or is he this kind of host body that's been taken over by the alt-right and is a favorite of the Klan and now thinks women should be punished and not men if they get an abortion.
So?
Well, I think he's a real estate salesman who is trying to make the sale in the moment. And he will say whatever he needs to say, whatever exaggeration, to make the sale in the moment. So basically, he's following the roar of the crowd. He traded in a perfectly good image as a fun huckster for an image as Hitler. And that's not really a good evolution.
Have you imagined a Trump presidency?
You know, I do know that he called David Axelrod when Obama first got into office and wanted to build a White House ballroom. He said, you know, the White House didn't have a suitable place to entertain people. So probably the first thing he would do would be to have a ballroom. In 99, when I went out with him, I was asking him what a Trump White House would be like. And he was saying it would be really fun with lots of parties and supermodels. And he's presenting himself so differently. Like, he used to be kind of a fun Batman cartoon, and now he's scary and dangerous and makes a lot of statements that unleash violence and Muslim kids are getting hurt and Muslim women. I don't think he quite understands the consequences of what he says, that you become what you say at the microphone.
Have you got a thought for Hillary in her debate prep?
Yeah, you know, what's going to happen in the debates is Hillary is working with a bunch of psychologists to figure out how to make Trump crack and go crazy. And so what she's going to try and do is like the scene from A Few Good Men when Tom Cruise gets Jack Nicholson to lose it and start screaming, "You need me on that wall." So that's what she's plotting. And he's plotting how to make her seem sick. The alt-right has spread all these rumors about her health, and she had the fainting incident. And so he's going to probably shake hands with her at the beginning and then pull out his huge industrial strength Purell and act like she has something contagious.
Oh, my. Will he have a rubber glove on?
Yeah, that's even a funnier idea. Yeah. So he's going to try and make her seem like she doesn't have stamina, and she's going to try and make it seem like he needs to be in a sanatorium.
And she's going to say, "Donald, I'll arm wrestle you."
Exactly. But, you know, that's a funny thing about Hillary, too, because usually with the first woman running on a major party ticket, you would think the issue would be her toughness. But no one doubts Hillary is tough. That doesn't even come up. They know she's tough. She can pull the trigger. The question is, does she know where to aim the gun, you know, as with Iraq, that wrong vote on Iraq.
The best of Maureen Dowd on the Clintons and Trump, going back to the 90s, is out in hardback titled The Year of Voting Dangerously. Coming up, a gamester child of the 90s, Keshana Gray, and the master collector of 90s nuggets, Kurt Anderson, from Spy Magazine to Public Radio's Studio 360. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What was it that sticks out from your 1990s? The peace, the prosperity, the Prozac, the Pulp Fiction, or maybe the early versions of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton heading to the demolition derby of 2016? Kurt Anderson was a star of the 90s at Spy Magazine. This week, he's finishing a radio epic on Donald Trump for his show Studio 360. Kurt, you loved the 90s, but was it not the raw material of all this strangeness around us?
In many, many ways it was. Of course, Donald Trump really became a national figure when spies started in the late 80s. But it was in the 90s that he and all of the kind of environmental readiness began. I mean, and when I see Donald Trump campaigning to make America great again, he doesn't say, oh, let's make it like the 90s. But, you know, that was the last moment when, you know, we didn't have we're no longer worried about the Soviets and the Soviet Empire. We weren't yet worried about Islamic terrorist threat. We had 4% growth in the economy, which we haven't had anything like that since. The tech revolution and globalization hadn't hollowed out our economy and transformed it. The creative destruction hadn't started. The only war we had was over in a few months in the first Gulf War. So it's interesting that it is, without saying it, a nostalgia for the 90s, because, of course, if you're running for president in an explicit way as being nostalgic for the 90s, who was the president in the 1990s? Oh, yes, Bill Clinton.
Kurt, you've written, sort of complained that the 90s was a kind of remix decade and that we've been remixing it ever since. There's something stagnant in the culture, not in the technology, but in the look of us even. What does that tell you?
Well, one thing it tells me, apropos this political moment, is that certainly in the case of Donald Trump, it's like he doesn't seem to lots and lots of Americans outdated and like some retro artifact, because so much of our culture and the way things look and people look and the way we dress and the way music sounds, the way architecture looks, so much has really not changed very much at all in the last 20 or 25 years, in a way that in neither of our lifetimes and our parents' lifetimes was true. I mean, things over the period of 20 years looked and sounded very different. Well, that sort of stopped. And it is interestingly, I think, connected to technology, that the digital revolution probably has sucked up all of the kind of cultural creative energy. That's where the change has happened. But in so many other ways, it hasn't at all. And therefore, the fact that Donald Trump, this oddly old-fashioned character from the 80s and 90s, doesn't seem oddly old-fashioned because so much is unchanged culturally since then.
Kurt, make room for Kishana Gray. She's MIT's visiting Martin Luther King professor of gaming studies, as in video games, and the riddles and roles, race, and identity angles that come with them. Kishana, welcome. Where does this campaign come from?
Yeah, so I look at these candidates and, you know, the circus behind them really is like this political stage. It's like a theatrical production and like a performance. And I liken that, you know, I'm a 90s kid. I grew up looking at, you know, reality TV. Cops was one of my favorite shows. But there was also another reality TV show that was peeking its way through and making its, you know, early rounds. And that was The Real World, you know, the MTV show on The Real World.
Sure.
And whenever I look to see, you know, whenever I look on the screen, I see a lot of, I feel like it's pre-scripted, you know, and I often wonder, is these folks that we're seeing on our screens, is this really who they are? So I often dream, you know, that the Trump that we're seeing is not actually the Trump that will be the president. So if he's president, I want him to say, ha-ha, I got you all. This was all a trick just to see how far I could carry you all, just to see how extreme and radical, you know, you folks would go based off of my rhetoric and what I would say. So I'm hoping for that.
So interesting. I've been waiting for this for months, for him to say, hey, now that I've got your attention, here's the plan.
Exactly. And then he'll do all these progressive, awesome things, you know, that would be really, really cool. But again, I see it more as like a performance. And especially in this reality TV world, you know, the lines are really blurred where you don't know what's real. You don't know what's not real. You don't know what's like a production, you know, that's backstage and like the handling of the politicians, the handling of everybody.
Let me ask you, what does the 90s had to do it. And specifically, the possibility that 9/11 just changed us forever, and that we're in a that we'll never be the same. We may never move, as Kurt says, the fashion hasn't moved.
Exactly. So I think that the collective memory, the collective consciousness, and that the collective trauma of 9/11, I don't know if it hindered or halted us, you know, in significant ways. You know, I'm not saying that we stopped progressing, but there was something that happened that is causing us to go beyond like a lot of these divisions that we have, you know, because we constantly return to them. Anytime something happens, like with terror or something, you see a spike in hate crimes, you know, with, you know, Muslim population. So is this our script for our next generations? You know, I'm not sure, but it was, you do see that there is something that we return to in the 90s. So if you think, in a person like me, you know, I'm a woman of color, you know, I'm a black woman in America.
From Kentucky, I wanted to say.
From Kentucky, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So let's say, okay, we're just approaching the 90s. You have to keep in mind, I'm still on the tail end of being referred to as a welfare queen. So that narrative is huge for me. So you want me to pay attention to these political actors that are devaluing and diminishing, you know, me, my community, you know, my population. And then you have something transition even a little further. On the other side of the class spectrum, you go to Anita Hill and you see that, you know, that could be and the political circus that was, you know, around like Clarence Thomas. And here you thinking that you're about to get some justice and some equality. You know, it's like going to be a win like for women, you know, all women. And then you see, you know, these kinds of this backtracking of like progression. But you see a lot of it now. I'm thinking about like even a lot of these narratives like around Hillary Clinton. You know, it's like this backtracking that we're constantly doing, going back and forth, as opposed to moving, you know, moving forward.
Kurt, part of it is just getting through the shock, the damage of 9/11.
Well, and because we had a decade where we no longer feared imminent nuclear Armageddon so much, and we had this sort of free zone where oh, it's all you know, it's peace and prosperity, and we're no longer terrified. And of course, we had never really, the homeland had never been attacked. And then so after winning the Cold War and having this decade of prosperity and all the end of history and everything's good now, we got our comeuppance very quickly and traumatically. I wanted to say, too, and of course, that's absolutely right about reality television, which got going with The Real World and the other, then the glut in the late 90s and the blurring of actual reality and entertainment that they have perpetuated. But the other media phenomena of the 90s that really are roots of Trump and Trumpism shouldn't be overlooked. He is, among other things, a Twitter candidate. Well, the internet really, of course, got going and blew up, and we all started being online in the 90s. Partisan ideological cable news in the form of Fox News and MSNBC both started in 1996. And we can't talk about the media transformation of the 90s and Donald Trump without mentioning the peak, the explosion, the gigantic success of professional wrestling and WWF and then WWE in the 90s, in which Donald Trump himself was a character, a regular figure. So your premise, the more I have thought about it in the last 24 hours about the 90s being the for better or worse, and probably in this instance mostly for worse, swamp out of which this present moment came, seems absolutely true to me.
Here's another voice. Nathan Robinson is founder and editor of a new magazine called Current Affairs. Sober sounding, but it's cheeky. It may be successor to your spy, Kurt. He's a graduate student in sociology at Harvard. He grew up in Florida and has managed somehow to retain his English accent. He gave us a very different take on our 90s context, the reality, the illusions.
In the 1990s, history was declared over. Mm. A lot of people sort of bought into this idea that with the Soviet Union gone, we were in this new era of consensus politics, and the original Clinton administration rather captured that. It was a centrist politics. Everyone loved Clinton. He was neither right nor left. You know, we all felt as if we were in a new era of peace. And indeed, there was a massive economic boom, relatively few foreign military entanglements as compared with prior decades. And so it was tempting to believe the rhetoric was all true and that Bill Clinton had healed all wounds and that America had finally come to a moment where the divisions of the 60s had passed us by and we had resolved them.
Sounds like a bubble, to use a 90s word.
Yes, well, that's an interesting thing about it, is at the same time as that economic bubble was growing and soon turned out to be a bubble that burst as soon as the millennium came, the sort of bubble of good feeling towards all human beings and peace and prosperity also burst, most obviously on 9/11. But the major underlying problem of the 90s that never got resolved was the racial problem. At the time, Bill Clinton was seen as a racial unifier. He was declared famously the first black president, uniting black and white. I think that a lot of this was PR. What you saw in the 1990s, at the same time as economic growth, was prison growth. Bill Clinton oversaw the largest expansion of the nation's prison system in American history, greater than Reagan and Bush combined. It was not an era in which the actual material conditions of black people in America were necessarily getting better. Incomes were rising, but at the same time, the prison state was growing and growing and growing. And that is something that has resurfaced in the last few years.
It's got to tell you something that the OJ trial from the mid-90s is being retried in two astonishing TV hits. One documentary, one drama.
The renewed interest in O.J. Simpson actually does capture something. I think it's more than just going back to an interesting story from the 90s. I think there's a reason that we're looking back on that. And it's because it was one of the most obvious moments in which racial politics played out in the public sphere in the same way as it is now doing in 2016.
O.J. Redux seems to me a huge story. What does that trial, O.J. himself, mean in recovered memory and the reality of 2016? First, Keshawna Gray.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the at the time, you know, when that was happening, I was probably no more than like 9 or 10 years old. But I remember the verdict. I remember tuning in. I remember it was a house full of everybody, and we tuned in to see the verdict. And there were cheerings. You know, people cheered when it was like, you know, he's, you know, not guilty. And you know, then watching the news and seeing the clear racial divide of, you know, black folks happy, white folks not happy. And I thought that was like a pivotal, because I couldn't make sense of what was happening. But I think, of course, regardless of what, you know, black folks thought about, you know, that OJ case, whether his guilt or innocence, it seemed to be like a rallying cry. Like, we had to mobilize behind him because the system was out to get him. And
right.
he kind of reflected, you know, what was happening, you know, at the time, thinking, you know, even on the tale, you know, we brought up with like Rodney King, you know, other the riots that had, you know, preceded and you know, came before. And so that just seemed to mark like a really significant time where, you know, black folks were like, okay, well, this is the person we have to rally around, regardless, for better or for worse. We have to make sure that he has our support because we have to vow this loyalty to race, you know. And then you have folks like me in my body, where you're like, okay, well, he did some ugly things to women, you know. So what about when are women's issues, you know, going to matter? So I think that it was always, and I think that women of color, you know, exist in this impossible realm, you know, where you're either having to vow loyalty to a race or you have to vow loyalty to a gender that's always assumed, you know, like to be white. And so you have to support these causes. So that the OJ thing is very, it's intricate. It's complex.
I want to put it to Kurt. We assume now that OJ did the deed. He was guilty and he was acquitted because of guilt around or anger around Rodney King, that there was a runaway jury there that was ready to defy the authority and the obvious sort of logic of the evidence in the case. Isn't there an analogy here? There's a runaway political jury out there coming up to this election, and it's in favor of Trump. There's a kind of populist swell under him that's happy to defy the line that Hillary's got so much more experience and all those credentials.
See, what I take away in this moment from the OJ verdict and case, of course, there was the racial divide. But to me, what's more, what I find more resonant and more true, it was this moment. It was this moment when, which I think happened in many ways in the 90s, but where people were permitted to decide on their version of the truth, empirical evidence be damned. Mm-hmm. Do you know? And that has, you know, that has always, that's not an entirely new thing, but I think it became in the last 30 years and through the 90s and up to today, a way for Americans especially to regard the politics and the facts of whether it's of climate change or whether I'm going to ignore the frauds and incompetencies of Donald Trump. I don't care. I'm going to declare him president despite all evidence to the contrary that he should be. So that's what I take from the OJ verdict, because you know, my sense in 1995 of the outrageousness of this verdict, I don't believe, of course, I'm a white person, so I would naturally say it's not because I'm white, but because it was so plainly, he was so plainly guilty, yet he was found innocent. It struck me, I was dumbfounded, and I have remained dumbfounded to this day, as I am during the Trump campaign, that the facts no longer seem to matter very much.
Well, in the OJ case, it was one man's freedom that was at stake. It's the leadership management personification of the federal government that's at stake in this case. It's a little bigger, you could say. Kishona?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I thought was fascinating was, you know, maybe not what happened, but what happened after, and how it seemed that, you know, people's opinions and perspectives, it started to matter. And so we had like some of the early stages of like this participatory culture where, you know, people could take part and public opinion mattered. And, you know, what people, their opinions could influence and sway, you know, a lot of these decisions in significant ways. Mm-hmm. Because like the political nature of a lot of these things, you know, you had prosecutors that may run for office later, you know, so they're paying a lot of attention to a lot of these things that are happening, to what, you know, that public opinion and that public sentiment is. And as he said, you know, all this empirical evidence, you know, be damned, you know, I think that that's a fantastic point, you know, that he brings up. And it even happens now, like when something happens, you know, people are, you know, rushing to like, you know, social media now, you know, we have it now. And I don't want to, you know, stay too contemporary since we're focused on the 90s. But I think there's this leaning to people saying, well, you know, my opinion and my perspective matters. And I have this realm, I have this space where I can contribute to these conversations and I can influence what's happening. And I think people are empowered by that, regardless if they're right or wrong.
We don't have time to finish this, but I'm intrigued that the 90s was a druggy decade, legit and heroin chic and Prozac, even on the Sopranos, Ritalin, Viagra. It's curious and interesting in some way. We got to nail it, maybe. The Donald doesn't, and never did, use drugs. Coming up, Joe Klein, the reporter, now the pundit, who gave us the Clinton 90s in fiction like Primary Colors and fact like the book The Natural. Joe Klein is remembering the decade without, forgive me, without irony. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Joe Klein's Primary Colors first attributed to Anonymous in 1996, makes any top 10 list of political novels. It's about a Southern governor and a ladies' man running for president in 1992. Looking back now as a Time magazine columnist, Joe Klein sees an imperfect man presiding over a near-perfect decade. He told me that if he were running Hillary's campaign today, he should be saying something like, "You never had it so good."
It was a real break from what happened before because of the end of the Cold War. All of a sudden, democracy was triumphant. Free enterprise was triumphant. Maybe we were all a little bit too triumphant. In terms of the presidency, it was an important moment of reform, especially for the Democratic Party, which had lurched as far to the left as the Republican Party has now lurched to the right. And Bill Clinton brought in a real new philosophy of governance. If you look at the United States during the period of my journalistic career, which has gone on far too long, you've had the tremendous growth of the black middle class. You've had wildly successful feminist and gay rights movements. The sum total of human suffering has diminished remarkably in our country, if not in the rest of the world. You know, and we keep on trudging on, making progress as we go. And those who now say that this country is a terrible place and we have all these terrible problems, A, have either never traveled to the rest of the world, or B, have been taken in by another phenomenon of the 1990s, which is the naysayers and pessimists and crazy people on cable TV.
Should Hillary be saying this as combatively as you want to?
What was the most successful week of Hillary Clinton's campaign? It was the Democratic Convention, where the Democrats posited an optimistic vision as opposed to the pessimistic vision of Donald Trump. So, yes, I think that the Democratic Party would be far better off if it, first of all, spoke to all Americans rather than various interest and identity and victim groups, and B, presented the country as it is, which is the most fabulous place to live in the world in human history.
We're speaking of this campaign as a kind of conversation resumed after the unpleasant interruption of 9/11. You seem to be saying it was a great time. Let's continue.
It was a time when some real progress was made, when we balanced budgets, when President of the United States didn't leap into Iraq and create the utter catastrophe that exists in the Middle East today. We're always in the midst of a conversation in this society. Two things that have changed since the 90s is that irresponsible governance put our national security at tremendous risk and also created enormous deficits by adhering to tax cuts that weren't justified. These are problems that can be handled, and in fact, they are being handled. The other thing about this being a continuation of a conversation from the 90s is that Donald Trump was never a figure of the 1990s. He's more like a figure from the 1890s.
That's Joe Klein of Time magazine. We're talking about this 2016 campaign from the 90s, it feels. 90s warmed over, overripe maybe, maybe tragedy, maybe farce. With our guests Kurt Anderson of Studio 360 and Kishana Gray, the visiting MLK professor in cultural studies at MIT. Could I ask you, Kurt, what is it since the 90s that has caught up with us in this campaign? And why is that happy decade feeling like a burden?
Well, because we no longer have the actual objective fundamental bases for the buoyancy. You know, we don't have 4% growth. We don't have a seeming cascade of peace and freedom around the world. So all we have is, you know, the vague Donald Trumpian wish to be great again, which is, as I say, a kind of wish to be like it was back before things got scary and incomes stagnated and all the rest. So the basis isn't there, and that may be because we're never going to have 4% growth again, or that may be because at least for the rest of your and my lifetime, we're going to face this terrorist threat. Life and because of globalization and because of automation. It's interesting. Do you remember more than a year ago, like a year and a half ago, the very beginning of the presidential campaign in 2015, Jeb Bush, he ran for president last year, said if somebody, apropos Hillary Clinton, if somebody wants to run a campaign about 90s nostalgia, it's not going to be very successful. Well, I would argue that Donald Trump is, without saying, calling it a campaign of 90s nostalgia, is doing exactly that, whereas Hillary Clinton, whom Jeb Bush was referring to, is, even though Joe Klein would have her do so, is not really doing that. So we don't have, I mean, we don't have the sense of victory that we had at the end of the Cold War. We don't have the economic prosperity. We don't have the obliviousness to climate change. We now have mass incarceration, which, as you say, didn't really exist until beginning in the 80s and then through the 90s. So we can wish things were wonderful again, but they can't be in the same ways, or certainly they aren't now.
Not until we learn something. Kishana, what's your take on what's catching up with us?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of these ugly legacies of racism, sexism, a lot of these things are catching back up to us because we've never really dealt with them in meaningful ways, you know, as a country. You know, it's always kind of existed, like right underneath the surface, and then something happened, you know, to pop right up. So a Rodney King thing happened. There's outcry, there's protests, there are politicians that are saying, you know, changes need to be made, reform, you know, criminal justice reform, you know, a different change in policing practice, putting dash cams, you know, in all the cars. You know, and then here we have, you know, we have like a Mike Brown or a Terrence Crutcher or any number of people. And then they're like, put cameras on the police officers. Let's have body cams now. So it's just really like this repackaging and this reiteration of a lot of these lasting vestiges that we have from you know, a time where, you know, black folks were, you know, three-fifths, you know, they weren't citizens, you know. And I think because we haven't really dealt with it and we aren't going to right now, you know, because you can see, you know, when something happens, you know, when we have a situation like an Eric Garner, and then you have two distinctly, and you can even kind of even cut it a lot of times, you know, along racial lines, you know, how people perceive and think about, you know, these events. Well, if he would have just complied. You know, so I think that's one of these things that's going to continue to come around, you know, as long as we're still not really dealing with a lot of these issues, like in meaningful ways.
You wonder how Bill Clinton's charm would have papered over the contradictions, or maybe how he would have addressed some of them. For example, the sorrows of empire, the regime change resolution through Congress had Bill Clinton's support. He didn't have to go to war, though, after 9/11. The color line has surely deepened. It's inescapable now in the incarceration statistics, in all sorts of measures, despite the huge growth of a black middle class. Inequality is a plague now in a country of, you know, it's now all children are born unequal and they will grow up unequal. Mm-hmm. The two-tier America is a terrible, it's an offense to everything we say we believe in. I mean, can you imagine a Clinton addressing those gaps, Kurt?
Well, I can, because he, along with Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama, are, you know, among the greatest politicians of my lifetime. Barack Obama, as much a fan of his as I've been from, you know, for a dozen years, in a certain way, while he embodied our better angels and, you know, we elected him and first African American president, how wonderful we are, how wonderful that is, how eloquent and fantastic he still strikes us, and why his approval ratings are going up. He in a certain way, of course, is both not in a perfect position to speak to these issues because he's an African American, in a way that perhaps a white president would be better suited. I think that's true. And of course, the racist backlash against the fact of an African American president is part of what right-thinking people find disturbing. It's not all of it, but it is part of it. So It is one of those very, very complicated good news, bad news instances.
Tashana, do you feel, are you feeling a backlash?
Absolutely. I think there is some sort of backlash, and I think this Trump effect. You know, a lot of people, you know, keep talking about this Trump effect, where he's empowered like a lot of people to really think to make, I guess, this Jim Crow era language. You know, this overt kind of racism, you know, apparent, and making it okay to, you know, say and engage and do like a lot of these things in a way that it hadn't before, you know. So whenever he talks about make America great again, I'm like, yeah, let's go back to, you know, before you were in office, where you, you know, kind of empowered, you know, a lot of these folks to really engage in these really ugly ways, to the point where we aren't even having conversations with each other anymore. You know, people are talking over each other because we're so invested in these factions, you know, I guess, if you will, that we're a part of. Can Hillary or can you know, Trump fix these issues? I don't see that happening. And you know, we aren't bringing people to the table that are qualified, you know, to kind of speak to these issues. I remember hearing there was a story they were talking about, like, you know, the racial issues like in America, and they had people who were former athletes. You know, I remember, like, you know, people think Charles Barkley is like, you know, this awesome voice of, you know, talking about like a lot of racial issues in this country. And you know, a lot of these comments and, you know, that they're making are wrong. They're not rooted in fact, and they're, you know, they're dangerous as well. But then people hear these great figures, great black figures saying these things, and want everybody else to follow suit and say, well, Charles Barkley said it, so why don't you believe it? You know, so.
Kurt, you want to speak to Kishana's fantasy that there's another Trump inside there waiting to burst out?
Well, if only. And I'll tell you, you know, in terms of my personal politics, last fall, as the campaign cycle wound down, and I thought that choices of Republican potential nominees, as it came to be, were Ted Cruz or Donald Trump, I had a moment before I became filled with nothing but dread about the prospect of a Donald Trump presidency, that, okay, Donald Trump, because he is not really an ideologue, but is, as Maureen Dowd said, a salesman trying to make the sale by saying whatever he needs to say, I thought, well, maybe if he's president, he will just do whatever, you know, 51% or more of Americans want, and maybe most of the time that's more good than bad. And so that was the nature of my faint hopefulness. So the fantasy of him becoming, revealing himself to be a progressive who loves people of all ethnicities and races and thinks women are as great as his daughter says he thinks, I think that is a fantasy beyond my reckoning. On the other hand,
hold it, Kurt. I want to introduce one last important voice. Part of what prompted this focus on the 90s backstory was a celebrated collection of new poems by Adam Fitzgerald, who's 32, making the most of his New Jersey boyhood in a close Irish-American family. The new book is titled George Washington. We ask him to read for us one poem, The Remake.
Jurassic Park comes back, Star Wars comes back, the Clintons and Bushes come back, but you do not come back. The Terminator comes back, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comes back, Game Boys and Payless, Billy Graham and Mike Tyson, they all come back. Romeo perches on a tomb, exiting the perfume of his grave. Little Orphan Annie, Tina Turner inside the Thunderdome, Kenny Chesney's I Go Back, YouTube girls singing Back to Black, Coleco and tanning salons, ninth graders popping E, they all come back, but you do not come back. Godzilla lumbers out of the ocean from a preserve of nuclear debris. Princess Diana appears over Egypt, bathed in a shawl of landmines. Pee-wee's Playhouse, Thomas the Tank Engine, syndicated reruns, reunions, and specials all come roaring back. Polio returns to Newark inside the eyes of Grover Cleveland Alexander. LL Cool J comes back. Bill Nye the Science Guy comes back. Total Recall comes back. St. Joseph's Aspirin comes back. The MGM Lion lies down with Lamb Chop. choker necklaces and fanny packs, Amos and Andy and Doc Martens, they all come back. The consumer revolution riots eternal spring. Twinkies and Polaroids, hatchbacks and Wendy's, federal bombings and OJ, cancer clusters and the mummy. In the golden age of returns, resurrections are replayed. From the feral gardens of my brain, Betamax and Norwalk viruses. Bruce Wayne and Bruce Lee, into an assembly hall they go. Lavender and termites, breakfast mints and green screens, they all come back. Goosebumps and wrestling. From a fold in the earth, outpouring of ground, we welcome them without you. While on the glint of a dime, the rigid nose of our 33rd president is alive and well.
That was the poet Adam Fitzgerald from his new collection titled George Washington. Last line, Kishona.
Yeah, I'm saddened hearing everything that he was talking about in that poem. I'm saddened because of 9/11, we didn't actually get a chance to reflect back on all the beauty of the culture that existed in the 90s. And I hope that we're able to return, you know, to a lot of that good stuff. You know, we remember the bad, we rehash the bad, we get documentaries about the bad, so we get OJ, you know, as opposed to, you know, some of the other flashes and bright lights of the 90s culture.
Kurt Anderson, the last word.
Well, I think we did, as a culture, fail. We squandered, led by a president who's helped us squander what could have come out of 9/11, which is to say, we are one people. Let's take this as a challenge to be one people and rebuild America and so on and so forth. The other thing that we haven't mentioned, but I think is part of the same sad syndrome, is I thought, and wrote even a little book after the financial crisis in 2008-2009, I thought, okay, we've come close to the abyss. We've learned our lesson about magical thinking in terms of finance. We will become our commonsensical American selves again. And I'm afraid that has been not as true as I'd hoped.
Where is the commonsensical American? Vote early and often. Thank you, Kurt Anderson and Kishona Gray. Check out Kurt's upcoming program on Donald Trump at studio360.org. Thanks also to Maureen Dowd, Joe Klein, Nathan Robinson, and Adam Fitzgerald. Look for more retro remixes on our website, radioopensource.org. Some nice surprises coming out of the vault. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. We had help from Mark Rendiro, and as always, from Max Larkin. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.